Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens, at the heart of Irish homes for over 40 years. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
So we're going to return once more now to the RTE Radio Archives with Damien O'Mara, who's here. Damien, good to see you again.
Hi, Claire.
This is part of the special 11-part Chapters of Magnificence series, which is celebrating some of Ireland's Olympic medalists. And Damien has been working on the series alongside his RTE colleagues here in RTE Sport. So Damien, after last week's European Championships in Rome, there's an awful lot of excitement, rightly or wrongly, about the Olympics. It really can be a life-changing couple of weeks for people who are competing. And that's something that you have discovered some people have struggled with more than others.
Yeah, and I think we might have touched upon this previously, that the greatest injustice we can inflict on people is unrealistic expectation. And the Euros, brilliant. But
yeah,
different ball game altogether. We've got, you know, the African nations, different, you know, anyway, listen. But there are people who will become star names over the course of the Olympics. And there are people that will depart to France and will come back from Paris with a much bigger profile. And people that have slogged away for years and hopefully have success that brings a different world upon them. So a lot of people have struggled with that in the past. Now, to their credit, the Olympic Federation of Ireland have done brilliant work over the last couple of years to identify that and to have a more year-round support system. Mm-hmm. In place for athletes, that it's not just a case that you compete for 3 weeks and we'll see you again in 3 years and 11 months time when the next one rolls around. One man who's been very, very open about how quickly his life changed and how he struggled to deal with aspects of it is Kenneth Egan. And even in that, if you listen to Jimmy McGee's commentary from the Olympics in Beijing in 2008, every single mention is Kenneth Egan. And I think if he walks down the road, a lot of people go, oh, there's your man, Kenny Egan. And Kenneth has talked about this in the past, that almost this creation, this tabloid creation appeared, and he bought into it by his own admission. The boxing in 2008 delivered Ireland's only medals of those games. Kenneth's silver medal and bronzes for Paddy Barnes and the late Darren Sutherland. Ireland's only medal at the previous games in Athens had been stripped from Keane O'Connor. So the boxers found themselves at the centre of a storm of kind of scrutiny, focus and interest. He talks a lot about the fact that he bought in too much to the caricature of Kenny Egan that was built up in the media. But he does take some solace from the fact that the experience he had has brought around that change in how athletes have been looked after subsequently.
I rode that wave of fame for a period of time and got myself into some stupid situations with alcohol and all of those stupid things, you know, and not being able to make decisions and the professionals knocking on the door, promoters. And it was just, I was all over the place and I couldn't really figure out who to trust, who not to trust. And it was tricky. It was a really tricky time and I was kind of felt myself, I was isolating myself. We went out there as a team of five. Did anyone expect us to win medals? Probably not, but we felt we were good enough to perform. And then all of a sudden we turned around, we're bringing back three medals. And there was no structure in place. There was no timeline. There was no, right, what's next? How do we manage these athletes? And it was just a free-for-all. And that, look, it was a learning on that, because the London, you know, they were more educated around looking after the athletes as people, not just as a product, you know.
As odd as it might sound, do you ever regret winning the medal for the difficulties it brought you?
There was times in my past after the Olympic Games where I wanted to just throw the medal away. You know, it brought an awful lot of hassle to the door. But when I look back at it now and the person that I am now and the recovery I have under my belt, you know, it was nothing to do with the medal. It was just my own self-sabotage. That's what I was doing, you know. Not being having the ability to stand up and take responsibility and ownership for my own behaviour. Once I managed to do that and stay sober a day at a time, I'm so proud of that medal, you know. I know the hard work that went into winning that medal. The endless training camps, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Russia in the middle of the winters. It's a tough sport at the best of times, but when you're in those environments, that tests your character. And when you can stick that out and come home and go back at it again and get beaten and go back at it again, people don't see the struggle, you know, but they see me standing on a podium. But to me, it means much more than just a medal around my neck. It means it's a sense of fulfilment, a sense of achievement, a sense of purpose that I worked so hard from 8 years of age right up to standing on that podium and the struggles I had right through those games, right up to the podium finish.
And he describes the work so well. That's Kenneth Egan. And then you could say that the Olympics, it becomes the event around which we remember the careers of people. Just like Kenneth says, like standing on the podium is what people see. But that can come at the cost of some of the other achievements. We don't remember them as well.
Yeah, like and somebody who will concede that they've had in that time complicated relationship with the Olympics is Sonia O'Sullivan. Now, like Sonia is arguably Ireland's greatest ever athlete and has done so much to promote athletics and to promote Ireland around the world by virtue of the successes she has, like a multiple world European, world cross-country champion. But I think if you talk to people about Sonia, they might gravitate back towards Atlanta in 96, where she walked off the track, and they might, you know, people will remember the medal in Sydney in 2000. She nearly stunned the world on her debut in Barcelona in 1992, led the women's 3,000 metres going into the final bend, coming into the home straight, and concedes in the programme that she didn't know what to do because she was an athlete who had spent her entire underage career being behind on the bend and then coming in and overtaking the person who thought they had the medal won. She does concede that despite all she has done and how difficult it is to win things like the Worlds, the Europeans and the World's Cross Countries, that it is the Olympics that really trumps everything in terms of what people remember. And herself as well says that after the, you know, the achievement or the near achievement, the near miss in 1992, that perhaps she allowed herself to be overawed with the prospect of what she needed to do in order to prepare for her second Olympics in 96.
I think I was just always looking for more. You know, when the Olympics came back around in 96, even though you have generally the same athletes running in the World Championships as the Olympics, the Olympics is always elevated to this greater level, and you think you have to be better prepared, you think you have to do more. And I think I put myself under a lot of pressure because I thought I had to. I had to walk off the track after every training session thinking that I was going to win the Olympic final. And if it wasn't up to that level, then I wasn't happy. I couldn't kind of put it aside and say, oh, well, you know, it wasn't meant to be today. And I'm sure the looming fact that there was some Chinese athletes going to turn up in Atlanta, he just felt like, I felt like I had to be a better athlete than I already was. So I didn't really accept that I was good enough. When you're at your lowest, then you lose a lot of respect and you lose that kind of aura of invincibility that you build up. And so you have to find that again. The Olympic silver medal was, you know, an Olympic medal that I dreamt about, that I trained for, that I worked hard for, and, you know, that I was grateful to be able to bring it back to Ireland and, you know, to be one of, you know, small number of Irish Olympic medalists, three times chasing it. Many people, you know, chase it all their life and never get any medal. So, yeah, I think I was, you know, very, in the end, I was satisfied with the result. It's probably a greater achievement to win the World Championships. I think it's a harder achievement to win an Olympic medal. It stands out as, you know, one of my greatest achievements just for what it took to get that medal.
Listen, we all appreciate as well what a straight shooter Sonia is on a panel, you know,
yeah,
most recently seen on,
yeah,
on the European Championships. You hang on to every word. We're 100 years in now competing in the Olympics as an independent nation, Damien. We had Irish-born athletes previous to that medalling as part of the Great Britain and Ireland team. So Olympic sport has played a really big role in the promotion of single island sports and athletes, of course, as well, from across the island representing this country.
Yeah, so Paris 1924 was the first time Ireland represented itself as an independent nation. As you said, obviously there was a number of Irish-born athletes in advance of that. There's some fascinating stories as well about Irish-born athletes who won medals for America and Canada who'd emigrated. There's a group called the Irish Wales, you know, in the late 1800s and early 1900s. But I do think we look at sports like hockey and rugby and all that has been done over the years to promote that all-Ireland approach to sport, and maybe the way that we've had great athletes who've represented Northern Ireland and have won Commonwealth medals, and you know, the fact that politics and sport for those occasions don't really mix. There's one element from the archives when you revisit some of these successes that really jumps out, and it's Wayne McCullough, who won a silver medal in 1992. And I feel sorry for Wayne in a way, because like Michael Crute's gold medal kind of eclipsed the fact that Wayne had won his silver medal, I think, two fights previously,
previous
and
to
the
that,
entire
yeah.
the entire country kind of descended on the Walkinstown roundabout and the Crute household. Wayne McCullough was central to the homecoming for Michael Carruth in Dublin. So they shared the open top bus, they shared the civic reception, and it wasn't a case of, well, the guy from Dublin has won the gold medal and the guy from Belfast happens to be hanging around, so let's include him as well. That it was very much a joint approach. Wayne McCullough is born and bred on the Shankill Road, and he kind of jokes and has joked over the years that he's probably the only man who landed back to Belfast draped in a tricolour who was marched down the Shankill Road behind a flute band. But when you go back through the archives, it's a kind of a reminder of an Ireland of a different time, where when he got back to Belfast, Michael Crute wasn't invited to Belfast. They didn't return the favour. And Wayne McCullough got a pretty underwhelming welcome back in his own home city, so much so that he came very close to walking out of his own homecoming, as he recounts in the series.
I've invited Wayne down for a weekend, him and his girlfriend, our fiancée, Cheryl. Oh, so he's going to return the compliment and I will go up and see him. So us two, whatever the troubles are, like, me and Wayne will always be friends and nothing will ever break that.
Did that hurt you, Wayne?
Hurt me, it threw me like a dagger. The funny thing about it is, Olympics in 88, Olympics in 82, I was unemployed. And then when I went down to the unemployment office, I told him I was going to the Olympic training camp and they said, well, you're not fighting for us, so you're not getting any money. And I was like, I'm fighting for the whole country. You're not fighting for it. You're fighting for Ireland. You're not fighting for us, so you're not getting your unemployment for the next 6 weeks. Going back to 92, and I remember walking into the city hall, and Michael wasn't there, so I just thought he wasn't there. I didn't really know. I thought it was a reception just for the Northern Ireland. And then Pat McCrory said to me, you know, the Lord Mayor wasn't going to have this reception. I'm like, what? Because you weren't fighting for I'm like, what? Wasn't fighting? I remember everybody was in at the dining table, like where they're getting their dinner, and I was still in the hallway ready to walk out. And the Lord Mayor was there. I walked over to him. I just looked at him and I said, I said, you don't know anything about sport, politics, anything, bringing people together. I said, I'm not going to this reception. I'm leaving. I'm walking out this door and I'm leaving. I was disgusted. Michael could walk up a shank of road with me. I don't care. And nobody would say anything to him. Nobody could do that to this day. And the door's always open there for him. I mean, but then back in 92, it was still pretty bad back home, but Michael was always welcome. And probably especially in the city centre of Belfast and the city hall, that's for everybody. Doesn't matter what religion you are. After the way they treated me in Dublin, the people at the airport, the O'Connell Street, I didn't have that same reception in Belfast. I didn't have that.
God, that's extraordinary to hear how he was treated. That's Wayne McCullough. Now, the series, Damien, is going to end with this programme paying tribute to a man whose influence really does seem to run through a number of the interviews that you've told us on the couple of times you've been in.
Yeah, it's remarkable the impact that Ronnie Delaney has had across the entire Irish Olympic movement. And completely unprompted, he has come up time and time again in conversations with people. In a number of regards, he is the man who, like John Tracy describes him as the statesman of the Irish Olympic movement. Sonny O'Sullivan talks about getting a phone call to the house in 1992 after she qualified for the Olympics, and he was effectively welcoming her to the Olympic family, which is a tangent the whole way through the programme. He was centrally involved in the establishment and the growth of the Irish Olympians Association, which serves to maintain a connection amongst the people who have competed at the Olympics, but equally encourages them to try and spread the Olympic message in their own communities. So the big message that Ronnie Delaney seemed to instill in people is, geographically, we might be this tiny little small island off the west coast of Europe, but internationally we can compete with the best. And that comes up time and time again. Michael Carruth in the dressing room before his fight in 92 turned around, said to his father, Delaney's days are numbered. I'm joining the gold medal club today. And Michael Carruth says his father knew straight away, this lad's going to go and win gold. There's phenomenal archive of Ronnie telling his story over the years. And one that I think people may not have heard of that much is the story of his homecoming. Won his medal in Melbourne in 56, landed in Shannon, and gave the entire country such a lift in a time of a petrol crisis and the IRA border campaign starting, that people basically lined the roads the whole way from Shannon Airport to Dublin as he gave 1950s Ireland a lift.
The coming up from Shannon, there was no flights into Dublin at that stage. The Shannon lobby wasn't required to protect Shannon, because Shannon was who came in. So there was a lot of beautiful, generous things, like the O'Flaherty Group very generously supplied motors for me. So I had the glorious thing of coming up from Shannon in some sort of an open Mercedes, which is still around. I think it's NNI 300, if you see it on the road. It's now painted white, it was then painted black. But the joy of going through, the significance of what was happening along the way, it wasn't lost on me, even though I was a young man at 21. I mean, if I could just go back, the 50s were so depressed. that my event was a huge lift in the mid-50s for Ireland. It's made a statement that said, Ireland, we can beat the world. We've just had one of our own do it. And it was a huge lift for the public. So the public were sharing the joy of this in a time of enormous economic depression and with no window of opportunity facing Ireland. This was pre-Lamass, pre-Whittaker. You know, the good years were to come. But this is a depressed period. And suddenly we have this joyful victory by an Irishman. And that public were sharing it with me. I can still see the faces of the ladies in the crowd, older people. I was a young person. And see the sheer joy, the policeman who waved the car through, his sharing of joy. It was a wonderful, wonderful thing.
Ronnie Delaney there, still supporting Irish Olympians. And Chapters of Magnificence continues on Sunday at 7:30 on RT Radio 1. And it has been extended by a week into the second week of the Olympics. So it's running all the way through. It was just slightly delayed by the election coverage 2 weeks ago. And if you want to listen now, it's available wherever you get your podcasts and via the RTE radio player. So it's called Chapters of Magnificence if you're doing a quick search for it. Damien O'Mara from RT Sport, thank you so much.
Thank you, Claire.
We'll take a break.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.